Okay, so welcome here, everybody. I am truly delighted and thrilled to be here. I don't think I have ever in my whole long life been given an assignment that I had a harder time with than this one. I am not good at math. Probably one of the things I'm least good at. Not a math person, if there is such a thing as a math person. But they told me that's what they wanted when they assigned this thing to me. I whined and complained. They said, no, we want somebody that doesn't know how to do math. Okay, well, hey, whatever. So I like words. I like stories and language and I like words. Words make sense and English makes sense and math is a nightmare. But I figured, you know what, I'm going to give it absolutely the best shot I can. So I went and I bought books and I bought a lot of books. And then I did something even worse. I went and read those books and about math. And I figured I saw a lot, learned a lot of things when I read. And one of the really disturbing things I found about mathematics is when people get really, really good at doing math, they quit even using words when they write books. It's just numbers and symbols and letters. And then there's this little moment at the end of the chapter where it's like the aha moment, you know, I got it. And I have no idea what they had said, and I took them at their word, and I laughed at the right times, but I had no idea what those books were about. It was horrible. But I realized that probably there are a number of you who do understand that kind of stuff, and you probably even know how to do those problems with all the X's and the Y's and the equal sign in the middle, And I mean, you probably can. And I'm sorry, because I'm not going to be able to take you any farther down those roads in these classes. But I think I will be able to help you to learn to translate from your own minds to students' minds that are a little bit more like me. Because we speak a little different language than you might speak with your mathematical brains. What I want to do is teach you how to teach a student like me effectively the language of mathematics. Because as I studied in my reading, I learned that mathematics is a language. I never realized that. And when I realized it, it seemed like it shifted into place for me a little bit more. And in a way, a fascinating world opened up to me that I didn't know existed before. A world of meaning in the symbols and things we call math. Galileo said that mathematics is the language of God. And he's right. So in this class, we're going to look at mathematics as a language and also as a story. And these first 2 days, today and a little bit of tomorrow, we're going to talk about the story of the discovery of mathematics. And in doing this, we're gonna find a different way of looking at and understanding numbers and thinking about numbers and to truly understand what is happening when we manipulate numbers and we do things, even really simple things in mathematics that we sort of take for granted. So if I were to ask you what all matter, in this room, the podium and the ceiling and the lights, all matter is made up of what is the simplest building block of matter? What would you say?
Atom.
An atom. Okay, but if you would take an atom apart, there would be electrons and protons and neutrons and maybe even quarks and things like that. And what would you say, if you were thinking of mathematics, what is the most... Yes?
One thing, if it's too hot in here, just open that curtain up.
Yeah, we should just open it.
You don't have to.
How my classes usually go there with the knocking things over. So, if you would take apart mathematics to its most simple building block, mathematics, what would that be, would you say? Like, what do we use in mathematics? What do we teach from first grade on?
Numbers.
Yes, it's numbers. But if we would go below numbers, numbers are the building blocks of mathematics, but if we go below numbers, and I want you to think about this, more basic, what the numbers represent and what we want to learn when we learn about mathematics is how sets of things interact with each other. It's not a number. It represents something. It's not just a random number six. It's six apples, or six pencils, or six children. And I want us to think about math in that way. Then we're going to talk a little bit about how these very simple things interact with each other. Just a tiny little bit right here to get going. So I have books. I was going to bring all kinds of little things and I forgot. Alzheimer's. But I have one book and I have two books and we add them together and we have three books. It's very simple. These are not numbers. These are things. They're objects. It's simple. A little child can do math like this before we get kind of complicated later on. You know, 3x squared plus 5x squared is 8x squared. 4 million plus 2 million is 6 million. 1/3 plus 1/3 is 2/3. When we sometimes, in our manipulation of the little symbols of things in mathematics that we use, we get away from what the math represents, and then it gets complicated in children's minds. So if I have, I have three apples and I take away one apple, I have two apples in the objects. And that's addition and subtraction. Multiplication is just repeated adding. You have five apples plus five apples plus five apples plus five apples equals 20 apples. Well, that's a tongue twister. And I know you know this, but I want you to understand multiplication is continued addition. Division is repeated subtraction. 20 minus 5 minus 5 minus 5 minus 5 equals 0. And we did that 4 times. And that's why 20 divided by 5 equals 4. And that's also why you can't divide a number by 0. Interestingly enough, if you go 20, take away 0, take away 0, take away 0, I mean, nothing really happens. If I have 20 apples and I don't take any away, there's always 20 apples there. And that's why you can't divide by 0. It just is 0. But these symbols, and this is where it gets interesting, these symbols we are using, this dialect of mathematics that we are speaking, is relatively young. It was discovered in India about 1,600 years ago. And it wasn't widely used in Europe until about 800 years ago. And what did they use before that? And that is where I was absolutely fascinated. They used unbelievable things. They used sticks and stones and knots and little statues and things like that to do amazing complex math in history. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because in studying that, I learned to view math and the language of math a little differently. Math is discovered. It's a language. We made a language for it, but mathematics is discovered. It's not invented. It's a little bit like Noah naming the animals. You know, here comes something big and hairy with tusks and a trunk and a tail. And he said, you know what? That's going to be a woolly mammoth. So that he could tell Eve about it. And when he went into the vegetable garden, you know, it was the woolly mammoth in the vegetable garden. It was something that existed, and he just gave it a name. And mathematics is the same way. These great truths of mathematics, the fact that 10 minus 5 is 5, they exist, and people give them names, and that's what we're going to look at, some of that's fascinating. Until relatively recently, nearly all countries used a different system of mathematics. And I don't know how hard that... So I have a little theory on that. So if you imagine the building of the Ark and the Tower of Babel, there's evidence of fantastic mathematics. There's evidence of great math. But then after the Tower of Babel and the dispersal of mankind, that evidence disappears for hundreds of years, for centuries. And I believe that when God came and confused those languages, he confused their language of mathematics. And they rediscovered it slowly over many centuries after that. Because we know that even neighboring countries in ancient lands didn't share the same language of mathematics. And now I just want you to think about that. They didn't share the same language of mathematics. So you're going to write a letter to your friend in the next country. And you get your little clay tablet out and your stylus and you do the little deals on there. And you want to tell them how many people are in your class in school. Well, you can't write there's 15 in my class. Because there's no... So you draw little men, 15 of them, so that they know there's 15 people in your class. And it gets really complicated when we're taking a shipload of goods from, let's just say, from Mesopotamia to Egypt. And this really happened. This is what they had to do. So every ship, so now in modern days, when a ship goes from point A to point D, there's like a packing list or a manifest, and it says, you know, there's 12 motorcycles and, you know, 14 pigs and, you know, 96, you know, I don't know, tractors, something like that. And when it gets to the other side, they go on the other side, it's like, only 94 tractors on air. Where did you sell the other two? You know, to keep the captain honest, right? Well, when they're going from Mesopotamia, they couldn't write a packing list. Because at the other end, the Egyptian agent on the other end has no idea what it says. And so what they did is they built these little clay pots. And imagine if we had to do this with mathematics. They built these little clay pots. And inside the little clay pots, they put a little clay representation of every single thing that was in that ship. So 500 bags of wheat, 500 wee little clay bags of wheat. 26 chickens, 26 wee little chickens, right? And then they took clay and they covered the top and they fired it and it became a single solid ball of clay. And it was called a boule. Wherever it's written there. It's called a boule. And it gets to the other side, and the guy, and if it's broken, then there's big trouble, but it gets to the other side, and the guy breaks it apart, and he looks inside, and he matches it up with what's inside the cargo, and you know, if it's good, it's good. And so they didn't have a language that they shared. You know, and it was time, you know, they learned each other's languages, and time went on. Okay. And in many places, there were, oh, by the way, these were not simple little math, these languages of math that both of these, Egypt and Mesopotamia were using were not simple. They were very complex, amazing languages that they used to plot the stars, to make their own calendars, to build gigantic, beautiful structures. It was a very powerful system of mathematics. It just was different. But in many places where math was not taught, they would use a system more like matching because they didn't have numbers. Imagine a living a life with no numbers. So your sheep come in, and we can count off on our fingers up to 10 sheep and on our toes up to 20, but then we start running out of digits, and what if you have like 150 sheep? I mean, you could in theory have a whole bunch of people with their fingers you could use, but, you know, that's really... So they would use a little pile of stones. And when the sheep would come in at night, the shepherd would take one stone and move it over for each sheep that went into his fold. And when the pile of stones got done, the sheep better all be in. Or that's how they counted. They matched instead of... Because they didn't have numbers. Imagine a life without numbers. And it actually still... The matching program works fairly well. Let's just say we have in here 75 chairs or something, and all the chairs are full. We have 75 people. So it's a good little system, but it has some serious limitations too, as you can imagine. But the idea of like a primitive man, the caveman and his ug, is a fallacy that didn't exist. Man is a created, beautiful being. And these people were intellectual. There was nothing wrong with their minds. They didn't know the language of mathematics. Their tools, the language of math that they spoke, was not that good. I think you could maybe liken it to trying to write a symphony in pig Latin. It's just really hard to make it beautiful with that limited... I don't even know how to speak pig Latin, but I'm assuming it's pretty limited. To get the job done. And so we're going to take a little journey through culture and through time and take a peek at the discovery of mathematics. Because I think in doing that, and understanding how we got to the numbers we use today, we can understand how to teach it and where we're going, and maybe even know where we're at now. So, which is pretty important to me. So first we'll go back to Egypt. Some of the earliest known math that we know about. The problem with the Egyptians is they wrote everything on papyrus, and papyrus rots and is destroyed, and so we know very little about the Egyptian math, except we know that they were really good because of what they did. But the one thing we know about the Egyptian, we know that they were really good because of the things they built and the things they did and the legacy they left, the navigation and the pyramids. But one thing we know they did that is interesting is the way they measured land. You see, every year, the Nile would flood massively. The water would come rushing over the countryside, move all the fences, landmarks, everything out of the way, and cover everything with mud, which was wonderful for the farmers, except they had no idea where the farms were. The Nile receded, and it was just a sea of mud from wherever to wherever. There was just mud. And so the surveyors would go, and they surveyed the land in long, narrow strips from the river. You know, here's the Nile, and everybody had little plots of land along the Nile that looked like this, with some good land, some medium land, and some bad land. But to make an accurate rectangle, a square rectangle, I mean like a, you know, is actually really hard. But they did it in a very, very simple way every year using triangles, using trigonometry. They had three ropes, and they made right triangles. Just like this. And they were called rope stretchers. And they walked up and down the banks, and they made two right triangles. One like this and one like this. With the ropes, and they pounded in little stakes. And every year, they had perfect fields because they used triangles. And we use that today a lot. When you're squaring up the foundation of a mini barn or a house foundation or something, we use triangles because you can make a perfect square with a triangle. They even use it for other things too. So in 1980, Texaco was going to drill a well down along the Gulf of Mexico somewhere, and the problem with this well, this oil well, was it was in the middle of a lake, and so they used this system, the exact same system of a triangle, to get to the exact point in the lake they wanted to drill, because they only had a very small spot to drill, because underneath the lake was a salt mine. And it was a really big salt mine, a really old salt mine, and they'd been mining salt there for generations. And so they did all their figuring, and they did everything, and they got their point, and they went out there with their drill, and they drilled this wee little hole about this big and round down into the ground. They went right into the salt mine, because somebody didn't do their math right. The water started rushing into the salt mine and melted the salt and washed the dirt in. And that 36-centimeter hole that they started with turned into a 1,200-foot whirlpool that the whole lake drained into. And then there was a big canal that went out to the Gulf of Mexico, and that all drained into it too, including 11 barges that happened to be on the canal at the time. And then the Gulf of Mexico drained in. Well, not the whole thing, but a lot of it did. And the lake went from this little, I mean, pretty good size, 9-foot deep lake into this of freshwater, into this monster 1,200 feet deep of salt water. No one died, but it was extremely expensive. I mean, houses and boats and you name it, cars and trucks, I went into that hole, and they're still down there, except some of the barges floated back out since for this. But the reason I tell you that story is it's very important when you're teaching your students that you teach them that these things we're learning are things in your life. These are real things that happen. These are things that have effects later on. It's not just numbers, it's life. I don't know how many story problems our students do. And, you know, you get down with the story problem, and there was Zeke having eaten 75 and a quarter hot dogs. And you're like, you know what? Are you sure Zeke could do that? And they're like, well, you know, we don't know. I mean, maybe. I don't know. Think. These are real things you're messing with. Help them to understand that what they're doing is not just numbers and symbols. What they're dealing with are things, sets of things and numbers. Have your students draw story problems. I mean, Zeke with 75 hot dogs beside him looks pretty overwhelming even to a pretty optimistic fifth grader. You know? So just make it real. Make it so that they understand that it's a real thing they're doing. But we move forward to the Sumerians, the people from Sumer. 3,800 years ago, they wrote on clay tablets, and we actually know a lot about their math because they wrote it all on clay, and we have it today. They did some really interesting things there that I want to point out to you. One of the things is their number system was completely different from ours, but they used, well, their numbers, they had two symbols for numbers. Those are the two things they used to write numbers. But with those numbers, they could write anything. And I tried to learn how to write math in Sumer, and I held it in my mind for moments at a time, but I can't teach it to you because I forgot. I'm just going to write. So let's just say we have a number like this. Let's make a number there. This number right here is, let's just pretend it's written in these little squiggles. And they understood place value, they understood decimals, they understood all kinds of neat little things. But this number right here represented the unit. So this number represented four apples, let's say. The next place over here in our math system would represent 10 apples, right? It's the tens place. Theirs was the 60. That represented 60. So this number, instead of 6 times 10, is 6 times 60. Which is 360, right? This digit right here actually equals 360, right? This equals four apples. This digit right here equals, one of these equals 3,600. Their system was a base 60 system. So every one you went over here, it times it by 60. So you could write a really big number, like this guy right here. 3 times 36, which is like 100 and whatever it is. That's a really big number. Like, you know, we're talking mega. Yeah, there you go, that one. And and so instead of 364 apples, it was like 10,000, et cetera, apples. And we don't know why they did it with this system. I'm probably wrong. Don't quote me on any of my math figures here. It just doesn't work. But they did amazing things. They made a calendar that worked. They did amazing things with their numbers. And they also, when they counted on their fingers, instead of using like a normal person, I mean like an American person would do, you know, 10 fingers equals 10 things, they counted their little joints. And they still do it this way in Bangladesh. If a student in Bangladesh counts on his fingers, he goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And it gives them a base of 12 on their four fingers. And it's actually super efficient. And I find myself doing that. And so that gave them a base 12 system. I mean, not a base 12 system. But a lot of their numbers are multiples of 12. We get our... So they knew a year had 365 and a wee bit days in it, but they didn't like doing messy math. They're a little bit more like me, and so they said, you know what, 365 is a complicated number. Let's do 360 days, because it fit in really well with their base 60 system. And at the end of the year, they would just add a few days, five or six, whatever they felt like was the right amount, and their math got a whole lot easier. The months, none of this 30 days has September business. They knew that, you know, it's just 30 days per month. Thanks to them, we have 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour. And it was actually really neat math. But we're going to move forward here about 1,000 years to the Greeks. And so I want to just think a little bit about how... We're going to talk a little bit about the Greeks and their math, but I first want to think about how they did their math. We're going to talk about what they did here in a little bit. But Greeks didn't have numbers, but they did math. And so they had an alphabet. And I don't know what their alphabet was, but let's just pretend it was A, B, C, D, E, F, G, like that, like ours. And they just used the first 9 letters of their alphabet for the first 1 through 9 letters, I mean numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 is A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, and however far it would go. And the next nine letters were the tens. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And then all the rest of their letters, until they ran out of letters, were hundreds. And it was a pretty decent little system, except the Greeks, nobody ever taught them about punctuation or about spaces in between their words. And so a Greek manuscript would be a solid mass of letters. No spaces, no lines, no commas, no periods. And you didn't know if they were numbers or letters. Because it could be either one. An A could equal one, or it could equal A. And so with this math, they did some amazing things, but it was really complicated. They also had, we'll get to that in a little bit. There's this man named Thales, and I'll just talk about him a wee little bit. And I'm sure you've heard of Thales. He's done some amazing things. He's the guy that had the donkey he was driving to market, and it fell over. It was laden with salt, and it fell over in the creek, and the salt washed away, and the donkey got up, and, ooh, light load. What a great idea. So the next time he crossed the creek, he fell over again, and melted some more salt. And old Thales is finally getting sick of this, because salt is expensive, and so he taught his donkey a lesson by filling up the bags with sponges. So the next time it was crossing the creek and decided to melt a little salt, Thales, he fell over and got up with this really heavy load. Taught that donkey a lesson. Anyway, that's Thales. So Thales loved mathematics. He loved numbers. And one of the lasting things he gave to the language of mathematics is he tied math with music. So he's sitting outside one day, and they're beating on the anvil, the blacksmith is, and then he goes over to the smaller anvil, and he beats on that, and there's a different note. And he says, that's interesting. I wonder how that makes sense. So he goes, and he starts messing around with things. And that's what Thales did best. He messed with things. He played with things. He enjoyed seeing how things worked. And then he got a string or a wire, and he stretched it tight, and he learned that if you stretch it tight to, say, the key of C, and you go to the very center of that wire, and you push your finger against it, against something hard, kind of like a guitar, and you twang each side, it's an octave, it's C, but it's an octave apart. Exactly an octave apart. Half of the length of the string is an octave apart. And from that is born our scale. All this is created. All this, that's why mathematics is the language of God, because it all makes sense. Do to do not only is the right sound, but it's mathematically repeatable every time. And he found out, you know, a cup of water half full is an octave different than a cup of water completely full. And the size of bells, half the size, is an octave different. And I don't know what this fee, fa, foo, fee, or whatever we sang down there, but I'm pretty sure, like, if you would, like, I don't know, maybe lay a dead cat on the wire, you could get, I don't know, there's probably, there's ways to get that, too, I'm pretty sure. So he goes down to, I'm amazed at all the people who could sing the fee-fa-fee stuff. I tried. I was one of the guys, who made it sharp, I think. So he went down to Egypt, and he saw the pyramids. He said, you know, a guy should really measure those pyramids. But being sort of a thinker and not much of a mountain climber, he decided instead of measuring the pyramids by climbing up with a long tape measure, he just poked a stick in the ground and waited till the sun was, you know, shining, and he measured the stick's shadow, and then he went and measured the pyramid's shadow, and he said, if the stick's shadow is this long for a stick that's, you know, maybe a foot high, and the pyramid's shadow is that long, well, the pyramid has to be this high. And he accurately measured the pyramid using his brain and some shadows, a proportion. Trigonometry, remember, the Egyptians were doing it. The science of measuring things by knowing the relationships between the angle and the sides of triangles. Angle and sides of triangles. That's really what mathematics is. The discovery of mathematics is finding ways to put into words these truths. So there's that too. I think I have to skip some stuff to get done here on time. So when the Greeks made a list of the seven wisest men that ever lived, Thales was at the top of the list because he loved to play with mathematics. So when your students are sort of playing with mathematics, Just let them play. It's probably a good thing. Thales is probably less known today than one of his students, who is called Pythagoras. And I'm sure you've heard of him in your studies. He was a strange person, an anti-establishment. He was a dreamer. He was maybe the original Greek geek. And he loved numbers. He loved playing with numbers. He's the first one who noticed that numbers alternate between odd and even, which seems really basic, but he was really intrigued with this. There's an odd and even program going on. He used pebbles. When he did his math, he did it with pebbles because it's easier than the whole letter business, and he noticed some really neat things. He noticed that when you multiply something, so you have some pebbles here, he noticed when you multiply something by itself, we have four pebbles and we do it times four, it makes a square. And that's why we call it squaring. We square numbers by making a square of these pebbles. And it's really neat, and it makes sense in your mind. And he also understood, he said if you use the pebbles as your units of measurement, you have the area the same way. And it's just really neat. And in doing this, he brought a tremendous wealth of information, of understanding this language of mathematics by playing with things. Another thing he did, and he did something a little bit like this, which is it's kind of neat. And you remember he's playing with this clumsy little, oh, you know what, you can't even see this, can you? Oh my goodness, that's horrible. You know what? That was really a poorly thought out thing. Let's go like this right here.
Oh, yeah.
Right there. And business here, boys. So we have, he did this. So he put this little, remember he's in the dust with pebbles. I'm sorry, I didn't think about you not being able to see the board. This is bad. Okay, so he makes a pebble, and he has one up here, and then he puts a little line in the dirt, and then he puts three more pebbles on here, one beside it, one down here, one right here. So he puts a little three up here, and this becomes his first square of four. Two times two is four. Then he made another little line down here, and he put down the next odd number, five. One, two, three, four, five. And the next square is nine, which is the next square number. And then he made another little line in the dirt, and he put down the next odd number, seven. Man, this is not working. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Oops, no. And then has your next square, which is 12, and then is it 16. And it keeps going like this, and it's this neat little table of your squares. Like this whole block right here is the square of 16, and you add an odd number each time. And in doing this, in playing with numbers like this, he learned to understand them, and learned to work with them and do some really amazing things with them. He's probably most famous for his theorem, the square of two sides equals of a right triangle equals the square of the hypotenuse, which I learned in school, and it didn't really seem like there was much value for my life, but you know what? It is really neat. So you have any right triangle. And if we could imagine this as just your basic right triangle, let's just say this is 4 feet and 3 feet and 5 feet, right? And if we could make a square that's the same size as this side right here, I know you all know this, but I'm just saying it anyway. So we have this square right here, and that's not a square. See, I can't see what I'm doing. And assuming this is a square, 4 times 4, if we would be 16. This would, the area of this thing would be 16 feet, because one side is 4 feet, right? Then up here, we make another little square. Oh dear, that's even worse. And 3 times 3 is 9. The area of this one is 9 feet. And if we would make a square right here, which is even bigger. Oh dear. Oh dear. That's just tragic. So 5 times 5, but anyway, 5 times 5 is 25. The area of this thing, oh wait, not 50, 25. you see why I'm not a numbers guy, right? So we have, and these two, if they would be like sheet cakes or pizza or something like that, if we would cram them both on the same pan, it would be a pan exactly the same size as this one. So no matter what right triangle you have, it can be one that looks like this. It's the same law. It's the same rule. And so that's just kind of neat, you know? And you can use that for all kinds of good stuff, they tell me. So, I mean, good thing to know. You can never know too many of those kind of things. He also discovered the irrational number that is the golden ratio and the whole... the golden ratio business, and I want to tell y'all, I tried super, super hard to understand this whole golden ratio business, and I literally held it in my head for minutes at a time, and all I can tell you though, I there's no way I could explain how all that works. I tried, you have no idea how hard I tried. All I can tell you though is you need to know about golden ratios. They're amazing. The more you know about golden ratios and that irrational number, the better. You can't go wrong with golden ratios. But anyway, so one of the other limitations in the Greeks' math was they didn't have decimals. They only used fractions, right? And they got kind of good at fractions because you can make fractions out of these letters. I mean, you can do A over, well, that's supposed to be an A. Let's make it like an E, the irrational number again. And you can do... I mean, if you knew all your Greek numbers, you could do fractions like that. But they had an interesting mind block. And that mind block was that the only numerator they used was 1. They didn't know about, like, 2/6 or 3/15 or... Wait, those should be reduced. But anyway, they didn't know about that. They only used 1. And so when they're writing a complicated fraction, like one Greek, he wrote... So this fraction, they didn't have this fraction. I could just hold. They didn't know how to write that, but this was the answer to one of their calculations, and so this is the answer they wrote. 1/2 plus 1/17 plus 1/34 plus, what, there's a plus in there, 1/51. Or however you say that. Right? That's how they wrote that. Imagine trying to teach your students math at that complex level. I don't know. Seems really complicated. But that's what they did. But in the middle of all of this mathness, along comes this guy named Archimedes. And all of us have heard of Archimedes and his bathtub and the crown and trying to see the... Have you heard that story where he leaps out of the bathtub and runs down the street forgetting, you know, to wrap even a towel? And, but amazing man, Archimedes. And he's using this really complicated, messy, not lettery system of math, but he does some amazing things because Archimedes loves to mess with numbers. And he's interested in numbers, and he enjoys numbers. And so what he's doing one day, one of the things he's fascinated with, and I wish I could just talk to you a long time about Archimedes and his numbers, but he was fascinated with pi. And now we've all taught, you know, pi equals, you know, 3.14, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on, you know, for infinity, as we know. But and what all this means... is when you have a circle, and all civilizations have tried to understand pi, the ancient ones. So we have a circle, and let's pretend it was made of yarn, and if you would take this circle, and you would snip it, and you would stretch it out right here, let's say it would be like that. Probably longer, but let's just say it would be like that. It would be longer. But and then you would have a diameter of the circle made of the same yarn, and we would have that piece down here below it. And their whole goal was to try to figure out what the relationship between the diameter, this piece, and the circumference, that piece. What is that number? How much bigger is the circumference than the diameter? So Archimedes is sort of bonkers. I kid you not. The man does not have much of a social life, as near as I can tell. So he's trying to figure out what is this number. And so he makes himself a circle. And he sets about finding this, like, like a mule.
So he, in this shape, he turns. He makes another shape, one that he can find the area of because it has square sides. Whatever this thing is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes, sir. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Hexagon. Am I right? So we have a hexagon inside here, and he can find the area of this hexagon because it's square sides. He's just got the triangles. He can find it, right? And then outside of the circle, he makes another hexagon, bigger. Or I don't know how many lines this is going to take, but we'll pretend it's another hexagon, right?
It's a nagon, anyway. and he finds the area of this shape, and he finds the area of this shape. And there's a difference in between them, right? Because they're different sizes, because one's inside. But he knows that the true measurement of pi is inside, is in between those shapes.
So he's like, let's get a little more exact. So in all these little gaps right here, he makes little triangles. Well, that's going to be triangle, right? Triangle number one. Triangle number two. And all what he does is he makes this shape into a much more sided shape. And then he does it again, and he does it again, and he does it again. And finally this thing becomes shapes that, you know, imagine just a whole bunch of little lines, wee little lines all the way around on the outside, all the way around on the inside, and it gets closer and closer to the true circle. And he finally gets, after all his writing, to this 96-agon, which is called a Eniocantakaya hexagon, something like that. Anyway, and he has this 96-sided shape, and he figures out that pi must be between 3 and 10 over 71. 71 and 3 and 10 over 70. It's in between these two fractions.
The guy was, and remember how he's writing these fractions? With a whole bunch of one numerators, the guy was truly a genius, right?
And he's right. Well, I mean, he's close. This is 3.142857, and this is 3.140845. Which you know, it's here's where it gets a little bit off, but we use this today.
3.14. It's a very adequate number. That he did by sheer force. Another thing he did a lot of. Yep, he did that too. So he another thing he's famous for is his relationship between cylinders. Remember, he loves shapes and he loves messing with shapes and he loves doing things with shapes, and spheres and cones. These are two cones right here, two empty ice cream cones, which is really a dumb thing to have, to be honest with you. And he figured out that if you have a jar of maple syrup shaped just like this, it has the exact, and these shapes are the same height, it has the exact same volume as both of these containers put together. And this cylinder has the exact same volume as a sphere, the same size and width, and also two cones the same size and width. And he also understood that if you would have and this was actually blobs of cheese, and you had a cheese slicer and you sliced a line anywhere through here, the area that you sliced through over here, no matter where in the situation it was, is exactly the same as the area you sliced across in the cylinder, which is really fascinating. I mean, the man had a lot of time, obviously. And then, you know, in the middle of all this, he's killed. Boom, and he's dead. And that's too bad, because he could have done a lot more things. So after Archimedes met his fate, some Greeks got together and they made the great and beautiful Library of Alexandria. And they compiled all the maths from before that everybody knew, Euclid and his business, and everything they could find, they got together. And because of this library that they could go to and read about what everybody else did, sort of like the internet, more or less, you know, just you have to go there, the understanding of math exploded. And in the middle of this, here comes this man who gets the bright idea to measure the Earth with the same ridiculous number system. And what he did is he heard, so let's just say this is the Earth.
He heard, and he lives in Alexandria, right? Here's the Earth. And he lives in Alexandria, and let's say that's like maybe, let's go with, boom, okay, that's Euclid. Let's go with here, maybe. Here's Alexandria, home of this guy named Eratosthenes.
And he hears that down south of him, a little farther south in Egypt, in Aswan, there is a place where on midsummer day,
the sun shines directly down the holes of the wells with no shadows at all.
And he says, you know what? That means the sun is exactly straight up above the ground there. So he thinks, and he does a little calculation. He waits for Midsummer Night's Eve, and he goes to Alexandria where he lives, and there in Alexandria where he lives, there's a stone obelisk that's sticking straight up. And it's been there for 2,000 years, and everybody knows that thing sticks exactly straight into the air. So he waits, and midsummer night, the sun is down below the equator. It's down here, shining away, doing its business, and it shines straight down through space, right down the hole of the well. It also shines over here to this obelisk. But right here, it's not shining quite straight on it, and it leaves a wee little shadow. Man, why is that marker so bad? So we got a shadow here. That's the shadow. Just to explain it. And he measured that shadow. And he said that shadow, as near as he can tell, is 7.2 degrees. And he used a fraction, obviously, but it was 7.2 degrees. And so all he had to do was calculate the distance from this obelisk to here, which his GPS was broke down, and so he had to figure it in camel travel days, which he figured a camel can go about 50 miles a day, and he thinks it would take about 50 days, more or less, to get there. And so all he had to do is figure out, well, first let's divide. So if this is 7.2, let's divide it into 360 degrees, which the Sumerians had divided it already up into this. Okay.
And I'm not going to do that. It just comes out to 50.
You can probably tell at a glance. But anyway, so here we are, 50. And so he realized that there's going to be 50 units that big around the Earth. You want to see what I'm saying?
He says, so this little gap right here, if the difference here, boy, now I'm getting complicated. 7.2. So this little gap right here gets you 7.2 degrees, blah, blah, blah. Anyway,
and I told you I'm not a math teacher. But anyway, he figures there's 50 little gaps like this all the way around the world. I had it all in my head before I started. And so all he has to figure out is this distance and multiply it times 50. And he comes up with, and he figured this distance correctly at 500 miles. And 500 times 50 is 25,000, which is actually pretty close. And you know what? Interestingly enough, if Columbus would have used his number...
Okay, right there. Appreciate it.
You know what? My students help me out with a little laugh so often you can't imagine. You just know when there's a little laugh that something went wrong. So if Columbus would have used this Eratosthenes calculation instead of a much more modern one, he thought the Earth was much smaller when he sailed. He probably wouldn't have sailed because it looked too big and scary. I don't know. But anyway, this was an accurate measurement. So the Greeks did some amazing things with their clunky old language and system of math because they were interested and they cared. And one thing that Plato contributed to math that's actually really cool is he tried to make it simple and make complex things simple. And one question that was bothering all the great minds of the day is how to double a square. How do you do exactly double of a square? And it's really, really complicated unless you do it the really simple way. And does anybody know right offhand how to double this square? Really, really simply without doing any math or trying to...
What do you mean by double? Like double the area?
Double the area.
Just make another one?
You know, you can. But how do you get it exact? It's really hard. Like to do it mathematically, it's really hard to get it exactly double. Unless you go like this.
they're supposed to be touching the corners.
And that's double, it's really crooked, but that's a double square. And Plato said, he said, when you teach math, you need to take the mystery out of it and make it into something simple and understandable. You know what? We're going to stop. That is what it is. I hate to stop like right in the middle of this like this, but so one thing I wanted to say really quick. No, you know what? We can't do it. We don't have time. Maybe tomorrow. Okay. Thank you so much for your attention. Tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit more about this story of math, and then I want to talk to you a little bit about different ways of learning math. And how some students view math differently, and some examples of that, and how we as teachers need to be aware of some of these different learning abilities and disabilities in math. But until then, we'll see you next time. Thank you so much for coming.